Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we have a special episode of the show with author Carrie Dunn and his new novel, Joe Peace. Welcome, Carrie.
Thank you, Sherry. How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you today?
Pretty good.
And tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
Well, I was born in South Texas and lived there until I was about 8 years old before moving to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Stayed in the Baton Rouge area until I got out of high school and went to college in the Austin area and lived there for about 20 years and got into computer work before moving back to Baton Rouge, so kind of a yo-yo-like existence. I'm married to my wife, Sheila, and been writing since about high school.
And how did you get started in writing? I mean, what brought about it? Did you do it in school, or did you just naturally tend to become a writer?
I always liked putting down stories, and I think when I, freshman and sophomore years of high school, we had more essay-oriented classes, and I did really well with those, and so it just kind of spurred my interest on. So, but I've always loved to write and tell stories, no matter how awful they are or whatever.
Does reading a book ignite your imagination, or do you get it from movies?
I read a lot, and I think more so when I was younger, books would stoke my imagination. I think nowadays, reading a good book inspires me to want to write and write better and see different ways of telling a story. I'm a better reader than I am a writer, and I don't. There's a lot of stuff at the top of the charts these days that really aren't my style. So, like the 50 Shades of Grey or the Twilight things, which is, that's great if you, can sell books like that. But I don't know, 50 Shades of Grey is like Danielle Steele for people who want to be spanked. And I'm not into that kind of stuff. But, there's still great writers out there that inspire me. But I think probably these days, Dennis Lehane, Elmore Leonard, Don Winslow, are the guys that I like to read that inspire me.
Do you have a genre, or do you pop from genre to genre when you read?
My favorite genre is kind of like the noir or crime fiction, things of that nature. But I will go from genre to genre if I can find a good, book. I don't really look for genres. I just look for a good read. And I don't know if it's my taste, but it gets a little bit harder to find these days. Just like on the New York Times bestseller list, top 10 or whatever, a lot of them just really don't stoke my imagination. But
I'm mostly a classic girl myself.
Oh, yeah? Well,
yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, that's
great.
I'm
kind of a hypocrite because while I don't like that kind of junk that I just mentioned, 50 Shades of Grey and stuff, some of the classics, I'm just don't grab my interest either. So, but I don't know. I know it when I read it. I guess it's like art, But so you read a lot of Shakespeare and things of that nature?
Well, I have, but no.
Yeah,
I'm more of Jane Austen,
mm-hmm.
F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah, he's the man.
Really good writers who write pretty romantic. But then again, I like Agatha Christie and Dorothy Sayers, too. So.
Yeah, Agatha Christie was my very first book I read, besides Tip and Mitten and that kind of stuff. That I used to love reading her whodunits when I was a kid.
Really? I mean,
yeah.
I always loved her. Well, I still love her. I still pick up. I can read books over and over. I mean, that's just the type of person I am. But the first one in mystery I ever read was Ellery Queen.
Mm-hmm.
There was a series on, I'm just going to show my age, when I was a kid called Ellery Queen with Jim Hutton, and I got so hooked on it that
dad... Yeah, it came on. I remember that show.
You remember that?
Yeah, Tim Hutton's dad.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Exactly. In fact, they had it for repeats for a very short time, and then they took it off again, which I think is a shame because it's a really fun show.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to see old actors, too.
kind of dressed in the polyester leisure suits of the day. So.
Well, it was, you know, they were supposed to be in the 20s, so they were.
That's right.
Dressed,
that's right. I'm sorry.
Yeah, they weren't really dressed of the period.
I was thinking more Macmillan and Wife kind of, but
that was
confused
fun
in my
too.
Head.
But, I mean, you know, murder, the NBC mystery thing. I've always liked mysteries. I mean, I don't write mysteries, but I love to read them.
Columbo was always liked him. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't believe he's gone.
I know. Peter Falk was great.
It's classic. I know. And I just let, just a minute.
One more thing.
Oh, that cigarette, you know, that was left by the car. you have any idea how it got there?
I think I would just surrender right in the before the first commercials. Like, look, I did it. Just take me to jail.
Take me in. Do I have to listen to you over and over?
You're gonna give me a migraine.
But the funny thing is, if you watch the show, is that you always could tell there were murderers he liked and he felt sorry for, and there was murderers that were just bad and he kind of enjoyed tormenting.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's true. That's a good point. Some of them, he was almost apologetic about, you know, having to bust.
He really liked them.
Right.
Yeah, and one of those is Janet Leigh, because she had a brain aneurysm, and she even forgot she did it.
I don't mean to laugh, but that's...
that's true.
I can't possibly pass a lie detector test, I guess. But,
yeah. Yeah, but he knew she did it, and he could prove it, but it was just sort of, it was, I there's certain episodes I remember really well, and that one I do, because she was really clever in how she did it, but the reason she did it was because her husband was trying to stop her from acting again, but the reason he was trying to was because of the aneurysm.
Okay, kind of a circular thing going on there.
They don't write stuff like that anymore.
No. Now it's all, blood types and DNA and all that good stuff under microscopes. So.
CSI.
Yeah.
Sad. Well, to bring up that, do you have a love of history? Do you like that? Is that part of your creating your stories?
I was a history major in college.
Oh, well, that answers that.
I read a lot of history books, too. I just, if I could, I don't know, if I won the lottery, for example, and could just be a history student the rest of my life, I'd probably do it. But I don't write really historical fiction. I like to throw in a bunch of historical trivia just in the course of writing a manuscript that generally, after the first draft, my editor says, I don't even know what this is. Take it out. So it never gets to see much of the light of the day. But huge fan.
It's mostly for your own amusement.
I guess, you know. I have so many student loans that, I got to do something with that. So,
major.
Either get on Jeopardy or something, you know. But I want to talk about the Pugachev Rebellion. No.
It doesn't have anything to do with the mystery. I mean, the story that you're writing.
I know, it's terrible. It can never fit in Stalin's first 5-year plan into any plot.
Why not?
It's pathetic. It's hard to do. So.
Well, I wrote a time travel story, so I had fun. I could put historical stuff. Like, I did the Civil War in the 1920s, and I'm sort of fascinated by both, so it was kind of fun to throw that in.
Yeah, wow. That's good. Someday I'll maybe... set a novel, you know, in a different time period, but have to get over some of my writing tics, particularly like curse words and stuff, you know, some of the tougher talk.
Well, they
talk.
Cursed back then, too, just differently.
Differently, yeah. They did much more politely back then, I think. So.
And Ella, you actually, if you read stuff that's from, like, the 1600s, you would never know it was a curse. I mean, you knew it was a curse, but it was so elegantly done that you would never know it was a curse.
Mm-hmm. Well, something like Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, I mean, was very offensive back then.
Yeah.
And, of course, who knows what he's saying today, I mean, unless you know Middle English, but, even the translations seem pretty tame, but back then it was so bawdy that he was excommunicated, I think.
Yeah.
So, got to be careful.
Well, a lot of stuff was raunchy back then, but it was so... Now you read it, and it's incredibly tame. You know, stuff that had the brown paper covers that used to be around books if it was thought to be bad.
Oh, right, right. Not deemed worthy of public consumption there.
Well, got as nasty and not proper, you know.
Yeah. Won't do. We're British.
Yes, exactly. What is your biggest satisfaction in completing your book?
Which time? Joe Peace was like, I think I rewrote it or edited it so many times. But I think the biggest satisfaction when I got through with it and knew that it was through was that I had given him this full life, you know, that... He wasn't just a character prop. He had flaws. He had inconsistencies in his actions, like we all do. He could be gentle or angry. You know, he's just a full, fleshed-out character as best as I could do. And I think when I went back and looked at it, it kind of surprised me and gave me a great deal of satisfaction because I'd be reading and go, like, why did you do that, even though I had written him? You know, it's like his motivations were his own, which... is a lot different than previous things that I'd written where I was asking myself, why did I do that? You know, why did you write this? You know, are you kidding me? You could do it. But so it was just very rewarding to me to know that he kind of took on a life of his own and that I was able to get out of the way and let him and the other characters do that. So it was a relief. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. I was just going to ask about that. So when you were writing the character and you were bringing it to full character, I mean, did you write like scads of backstory? How do you feel you brought that character to full life?
I think because generally it was three different versions, rewrites. And the more I wrote this character, the more I liked him, and the more, you know, I initially wrote it in third person, and he was kind of unlikable as a result. I mean, this is a crime boss who's, you know, kind of going through some midlife crisis type stuff, and I was just too detached from it, and so very unsympathetic in that regard. But when I switched to first person and was able to kind of get in his head and, you know, show his motivations, after a while of writing, his motivations kind of took on a life of their own. So it probably sounds psychotic or something, but, you know.
No, sounds like a writer.
Yeah, you got into the fictive dream, and it was pure bliss to go that.
Yeah, there's something satisfying about bringing something from your imagination to the page and then fleshing it out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure even how to explain that to someone who doesn't write.
I think if you, and not that I'm comparing myself to these guys or anything, but if you listen to Miles Davis play or Oscar Peterson or, you know, any talented musician, you know, I wouldn't understand how they could ever come up with that. But to them, it's like second nature. And like I said, I'm not comparing myself to any of these cats, but at a lower level, you know, when you kind of reach that plateau where you're actually, you know, doing what you're supposed to do as a writer, it feels great.
Yep, absolutely. It's very, very much a high. When you're working on your writing, how do you find the time? I mean, do you, like, make deals with your family, or is there a certain time that's non-communicato time, or do you just do it with all the noise around you?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in a large family. I have 8 siblings, so really I can probably write in a war zone or read in a war zone. I mean, they're just, you'd never really had any peace and quiet. I'm used to... to noise. When I do write, it's usually late at night, after lights out, just because full-time job and pretty busy with that and spending time with my family and friends. But as I get further and heavier into a book, I kind of withdraw much more than at the start of it, you know, once I'm really into the story. I think I've always just been blessed by people that have, you know, understood that I like to write and that this is what I love to do, and let me do it without any need for deal making or anything like that. I make certain that I return the favor by giving them what they need, but I've been really blessed in that regard.
You're very lucky. You're very lucky. Hello? Karen?
Hello?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, are you calling for a question?
Yes.
Hello?
What's your question?
Hi, I'd like to know if Joe Peace were made into a movie, what would what actor does Carrie Dunn see playing Joe Peace? Who do you think would make a good Joe Peace in a movie?
Okay, let me. Joe, Carrie, did you hear that?
Part of it. I'm sorry. There was a voice saying muted that kind of cut some of it off. I didn't really hear it all.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
Caller, could you repeat your question again?
Yes. If there was a movie made of Joe Peace, what actor would you see playing the character Joe Peace? Who can we picture as Joe Peace in your mind?
Oh, I kind of went through a couple of different ones. I think, actually, when I was writing the book, I had Paul Giamatti in mind for some reason, even though he's kind of a schlub, but he's, you know. I think when I got through with it, though, I think Robert Downey Jr. would probably be able to win an Oscar with playing this role, if he happens to be listening. This is your big moment. No, but Robert Downey Jr.
Here's your chance.
Yeah, there you go, man. Or even Bruce Willis. I think they'd have to be somebody kind of near middle age that has some life to their face and that can play kind of unsympathetic, but yes, still keep the audience's sympathy. But, of course, my luck, it'll end up Adam Sandler will buy the movie rights and turn it into a comedy. But what are you going to do?
Okay, thank you.
Great question. Thank you, caller. You were answering about your family. Tell us about how you find the time to write.
Yeah, I just, it's, like I said, mostly lights out. Weekends are a big time for me to write. As I get further on into the book, I'll get home from work, spend an hour or two, you know, just when I can. I'm not, you know, I know like Stephen King says, you know, you have to write every day. I don't do that. I just, there's, yeah, I don't have Stephen King's ability to write every day for a living, but I just write, when I sit down to write, I write big batches, you know, it's I'm really productive during the small amount of time I have, so it all works out.
Well, that's really cool. Looks like we have another caller. Hold on just a second. Caller, do you have a question for Carrie?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine. Thank you.
I was wondering why he chose Austin as a setting for the book.
Carrie,
why I chose Austin as a setting for the book?
Yeah, she wants to know why you chose Austin as a setting.
Because it, I lived there, as I said, for 20 years, but it's just got a special place in my heart, and when I was writing the book, it was kind of from Joe is very nostalgic, and the book goes kind of back and forth between present day and his relationship with a woman back in the late 80s, early 90s. And so his nostalgia for that time kind of matched my nostalgia for Austin, which I had left a few years before writing this book. I was living in Baton Rouge, and it just fit. I just... his entire characterization of being kind of this laid-back, kind of not hippie, but, you know, very laid-back dude, kind of fit the Austin culture, I thought, much better than any other city. And Austin becomes kind of its own character in this book. And
well, it's cool. I like that kind of a thing where the city becomes part of the book. Great question, caller. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Can you give us a taste of your book? And what do you want your readers to take away from the experience?
Okay. Well, yeah, Joe Peace, just to summarize briefly, is the story of this cop who jumps a fence and becomes a criminal and kind of starts running his own crew. And his main muscle is offed by some rival gangs, and the rival gangs are trying to take over his operation. But at the same time, some things come to the fore regarding a relationship with a fellow police officer he had back in the 80s who was killed on the job. And so as he's trying to fend off these other rival gangs, he's also trying to make sense of his past and get to some moral center that he's been missing for all these years. And I think what I'd like readers to take away from it, it makes me feel good that when people read it, say that, you know, they end up rooting for him, and they wouldn't have ever imagined that they could root for a guy like this. And that gives me a great deal of pleasure to hear that, because I put a lot of effort into making him, even though he has a very unsympathetic lifestyle, he becomes a sympathetic character. And it's very rewarding for me that people say that.
That's really the best, though, isn't it? Is that when you put something out and it comes back tenfold, I mean,
right.
You feel like you got into the World Series and you got the ring.
Exactly. I mean, again, because like the first draft, you know, in third person, if I'd have left it that way, first of all, I probably wouldn't be talking to you here today because the book wouldn't be published. But it was just pretty much mocking everything, you know, like detached third person, stay away from me, this guy's a jerk. So there was no point in reading it. But when I put it inside his head and kind of saw things from his point of view, I think it made me more sympathetic as a writer. So hopefully the reader sees him, you know, sympathetic as well.
Sort of like The Godfather.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's kind of the stuff I'm raised on. So, you know, those types of stories. But the Tarantino-esque, you know, I don't know, you watch Pulp Fiction and Samuel L. Jackson's, you know, you root for him even though he's a, you know.
A horrible killer.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I saw the movie and I'm not really into violence, so I was like, didn't really like it that much. But my dad told me, read the book, it's better. So I read the book and I went, wow, it is better. It's
The Godfather.
Yeah, you have a lot much more sympathy for the characters in the book, The Godfather, than in the movie. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the movie was more, well, they're both great. I love them
both.
Yeah,
of course.
But,
classic.
The movie, they had to cut out, I mean, as long as it was, they had to cut out so much of the backstory type stuff, you know, where, like in the book, Sonny's much more sympathetic than he is in the movie, you know.
Yeah,
even though he's a great character, but in the book, when he, you know, spoiler alert here, when he gets shot up at that toll booth, you know, it has a great deal of impact. But in the book, you know, you're just like, oh man, Sonny's gone.
Yeah, because he also had that great sense of humor,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is missing in Michael. Michael
right.
had no sense of humor.
No, he is pretty much a drip.
Yeah, not my favorite character.
He gets better, in the second Godfather part two. I thought
he
was much more interesting there. But I guess he had to go through his growing pains.
He was so sanctimonious.
Right, right. And I thought in the movie, one thing it did was kind of show his transformation to joining the family a little better. You know, the book, it was just kind of all of a sudden, hey, I'm going to go, you know, I'll kill the Turk and this police captain, you know, and go on the run. And they're like, okay. But, you know, in the movie, I think it kind of showed more, I guess, Pacino's acting.
Well, it helped have Pacino.
It. Yeah.
Yeah. So that goes back to you picking an actor for your movie. Do you think that, okay, you pick somebody, but is that if he doesn't play it the way you want it to be, will you feel bad that you set that out? Because I didn't know that Al Pacino played exactly the way Mario Puzo wanted it, even though he did like it. It wasn't the way he wrote it.
Oh, right. And you see that all the time, you know, a novelist, their book gets made into a movie, and they're like, oh, how can they cast him or whatever, you know. I totally disassociate from myself from this movie kind of stuff. But, I mean, I think, well, especially because I have no clout. I mean, if my book did sell and they put whoever in it, they could care less what I would say about it, I'm sure. I mean,
yeah, writers don't have clout in Hollywood.
We could care less. So, you know, that's how you get, and he's a great actor, but it's how you get Tom Hanks is the lead in Bonfire of the Vanities, and it's like, really? Come on, who thought of that? You know, who thought that was a good idea?
But the writers are very important. I mean, if there wasn't for the word, they wouldn't have a movie.
Right. Unless, I guess, was one of pictured the artist. No, I'm just kidding. But, I mean, the words are the
favorite,
backbone.
But
no, mine either. Words are the backbone. I mean, Casablanca, it's what do you think of? You think of the words. Of course, it's a relationship, I think, between the actors and, you know, what they have to say, but I've seen great actors in terribly written movies, and the movies are awful. So
true.
It takes two to tango.
The thing is that one of the, like you were saying, you like the genre, like the murder mysteries. I was thinking like Maltese Falcon. The writing is everything in that. I mean, the actors are brilliant, but the key of that movie is the brilliant writing.
Exactly. And I don't know if you've ever read the book, The Maltese Falcon.
Yes, I have.
How closely it, I'm sorry, I figured you did, but how closely it adheres to the movie. I mean, it's like they barely changed anything. I think they took out one of Sam Spade's recollections about hunting down a guy who had skipped out on his wife or whatever. But other than that, I mean, it pretty much followed the book word for word.
And that's because of John Huston.
Yes. Who knew what he was doing. If you have Dashiell Hammett writing words, you might want to use as many of them as
you can.
You might
use most of the words that Dashiell Hammett wrote.
Yeah, just do that and you'll be okay.
Yeah. But then there's movies that they hardly use the script. They kind of use it for just they buy it just for the thing, and then it's not a great movie. You know, they just buy it for the title or the kind of the notion of the film, notion of the book, and that's about it.
Yeah, and then they'll completely gut it or change, 80% of the book into something else. And it's like, what did you do that for? It's, again, Bonfire of the Vanities. If you've ever read the book and seen the movie, it's like, I don't think you'd ever recognize that this movie came from that book kind of thing. I mean, it's just.
Yeah, I mean, there's a crazy comedy from the 60s called Sex and a Single Girl. The original book was written by Helen Gurley Brown, which is a self-help book. The only thing they used was her name and the title. It had nothing to do with it at all.
That was a Joy Heatherton feature, wasn't it?
No, Natalie Wood.
Natalie Wood, I'm sorry. Yeah. Joy Heatherton was a happy hooker. Okay.
Yeah, different one.
Different
one. No, Natalie Wood, Tony Curtis. Good movie if you don't know what the book is.
I think I missed both. I guess because never been a single girl. Yeah.
No, it's just really funny.
I imagine.
it's like one of those wild, rompy comedies with every comedian you ever can think of in.
Kind of like It's a Mad
to do
mad
a lot
world.
In the 60s. Okay, we only have a few minutes left, so I just want to thank you for a wonderful interview. Can you just tell us a little bit, because we only have a little bit of time, what you're working on now?
I'm halfway through a book called It's a Singer and Not the Song, about this former one-hit wonder in the 70s who's playing piano in a dive bar in the French Quarter and kind of gets caught up with some of the underworld types there and gets into trouble. I don't know if he gets out of it, but that's where he is right now.
That sounds good. That sounds great. I want to thank you, Carrie. It was a wonderful interview. This Tuesday, we'll be interviewing the lovely Christine Hansen about her novel, A Hairdresser's Diary. I'd like my live audience to thank Carrie for a wonderful interview. Thank you, Carrie. It was great.
Thank you, Sherry. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Anytime. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.